Hello and welcome to The Deep Dive, where we take a stack of your sources and really try to extract the most important nuggets of knowledge and insight. Today, we're embarking on quite a fascinating journey, I think, to the daily blueprint of federal government action. We're digging into the Federal Register for Friday, August 15th, 2025. I'm Alex Smith, your guide to uncovering some of those surprising facts and connecting the dots.
And I'm Taylor Johnson, here to help us synthesize all this information, understand its broader context, and really explore why it truly matters for you. The Federal Register is, well, it's really a treasure trove. It's the official daily publication of rules, proposed rules, notices, you know, from federal agencies and organizations, plus executive orders and other presidential documents. Think of it as the ultimate public record, really, day by day, what the government is doing, proposing, and observing.
Right. And our mission today is to cut through maybe some of the jargon, the density, to give you a shortcut to being truly well-informed about the day's most impactful federal actions. We'll explore each category: presidential documents, rules and regulations, proposed rules, and notices, and discuss the, you know, the real-world implications.
Okay, let's unpack this. Let's jump right into the executive branch's directives first. So, presidential documents. We're starting with a presidential memorandum. It details something called preclearance or pre-inspection at a site outside the customs territory of the United States. This comes from the Department of Agriculture's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, APHI. What exactly does this preclearance mean, and who does it affect?
Right. So this memorandum, it's all about how fees are set up and administered for agricultural quarantine inspection services, AQI services, performed by APHIs, but overseas. So imagine, you know, clearing customs in those agricultural checks before you even get on the plane or the ship heading to the U.S.
Oh, okay. So it speeds things up on arrival. Exactly. It significantly streamlines arrival for international travelers and cargo, cuts down potential delays once you actually hit the American border. And the core principle here, it's stated right in the memo, is that the fees collected have to match the costs. They must be commensurate with the costs of AQI services. For passengers, this isn't just about, say, your suitcase. It also covers the costs of inspecting the aircraft or the vehicle itself. It's basically a classic user fee model, ensures that the costs of this really crucial biosecurity work protecting us from pests and diseases are recovered from those using the service.
Okay, that sounds pretty standard for government services, like you pay for the service you get. But are there any, I don't know, interesting exceptions or details here that stand out?
Oh, absolutely. This is where you see the incredible granularity of federal regs. The memo specifies particular exemptions for certain types of aircraft. For instance, planes with fewer seats can be exempt if they're not carrying specific types of high-risk cargo.
Like what kind of cargo?
Things like fresh fruits, vegetables, unprocessed plant products, cotton, sugar cane, or fresh or processed meats. Stuff that could potentially carry pests or diseases, right? And it gets even more specific. The exemption also applies if these aircraft don't offer meal service other than beverages and prepackaged snacks. And those snacks can't contain meats from ruminants, swine, or poultry, or fresh fruits and vegetables.
Wow. So if you're on a small private jet just getting a soda and pretzels, you might skip some fees.
Pretty much. That's the level of detail. However, and this is important, even these exempt aircraft are still subject to strict garbage handling requirements. It really underscores the constant vigilance needed, you know, preventing pests and diseases, even from what seem like minor operations. And just for the record, the memorandum was signed by Michael Watson, the APIS administrator, on August 8th, 2025.
So boiling it down, what does this all mean for you, the traveler, or maybe for industries involved in international transport?
Well, it means potentially a smoother, faster process if you're on one of these pre-cleared flights, inspections handled before you even get to U.S. soil. But it also highlights the incredibly specific, detailed thinking that goes into protecting U.S. agriculture and natural resources. It shows how government adapts user fees, tailors them to cover specific costs, even down to the types of snacks served on a plane, all in the name of biosecurity. It's quite something.
Okay. Moving into the rules and regulations section now, this is the stuff that's basically the law of the land today. First up, the Department of Transportation, specifically the Federal Aviation Administration, the FAA. They're issuing special conditions for a Jet Aviation AG Gulfstream Model GVI airplane. Sounds very technical. Aircraft design stuff. What's the gist here?
Yeah, this is a really fascinating example of how regulations have to constantly evolve with technology. So the Gulfstream GVI, a specific type of business jet, as modified by this company, Jet Aviation AG, it's incorporating what the FAA calls a novel or unusual design feature.
Okay, what's novel about it?
It's an oxygen distribution system, but it provides a shared source of oxygen for both the flight crew and the passengers, and it's used for both supplemental oxygen, like if cabin pressure drops, and therapeutic oxygen, maybe for a medical need.
Ah, so usually those systems are separate.
Often, yes, or they have different specific provisions. So this shared system, it presents new safety considerations that weren't really anticipated in the existing rules. The FAA decided that the current airworthiness regulations didn't adequately cover the specific shared setup, hence these new special conditions. They basically contain extra safety standards, things the FAA considers essential to maintain an equivalent level of safety for everyone on board, making sure this new design is just as safe as the old ways.
So what are the practical implications for, say, a passenger on one of these planes or for the aerospace industry always pushing boundaries?
For passengers, it means that these new advanced therapeutic oxygen systems on private aircraft are being very rigorously evaluated, regulated to ensure they're safe and reliable, especially in an emergency. For the industry, well, it sets a precedent. It shows how future novel designs, especially ones integrating systems in new ways, will be assessed and approved by the FAA. These special conditions became effective immediately, August 15th, for Jet Aviation AG. And interestingly, comments are actually still open until September 29th. So there's still a window for public input on these specific safety standards, even though they're in effect.
Right.
It also means these same conditions would likely apply if they install this feature on other Gulfstream models under the same type certificate. Shows the FAA thinking ahead.
Okay, next item. We're shifting to another critical area of public safety. One where rapid government action is often essential, the fight against dangerous new drugs. Let's turn to the Department of Justice, the Drug Enforcement Administration, or DEA. They're focusing on substances with incredibly long names, N-pyrrolidino metonidazine and N-pyrrolidino protonidazine. What are these things and why is the DEA scheduling them?
Right, those are mouthfuls. These are what are known as novel synthetic opioids, commonly referred to on the illicit market as nitazenes. They have a pharmacological profile, meaning how they affect the body, that's very similar to highly dangerous drugs like fentanyl and morphine, often incredibly potent.
So are these brand new?
The DEA has actually been grappling with this whole class of drugs, the nitazenes, since about 2019. They've already had to temporarily control 10 others just between August 2020 and March 2024. These two specific ones, N-pyrrolidino metonidazine and N-pyrrolidino protonidazine, are among the more recently identified popping up on the illicit drug market. It shows how quickly these things evolve.
And the threat is real.
Oh, very real. And escalating. Since just 2023, law enforcement agencies across the country have reported 123 exhibits related to trafficking, distribution, and abuse of these specific substances. That's what they reported to the NFLIS drug database. N-pyrrolidino metonidazine alone, for example, had 10 encounters reported from places like Florida, Maine, Missouri, Ohio. And N-pyrrolidino protonidazine showed up in 113 exhibits. So that suggests a pretty broad presence in the illicit market already.
You know, what really jumps out at me about this DEA action, it's called a temporary scheduling order, not just a regular rule. That sounds like a significant legal difference. What's behind that? How does it change things?
Yeah, that's a crucial legal distinction. And it really speaks to the urgency here. The Controlled Substances Act gives the DEA a special tool for situations like this. Under Section 811, they can issue a temporary scheduling action by order, which is legally distinct from a formal rule.
And what does that difference mean in practice?
It means the usual notice and comment requirements of the Administrative Procedure Act. They just don't apply.
Ah, so they can skip the lengthy public comment period.
Exactly. It allows the DEA to act incredibly swiftly to protect public safety from what they see as an imminent threat from these dangerous substances. It bypasses the months, maybe even years, of formal rulemaking procedures and potential judicial review that permanent scheduling would normally entail. It's really a testament to the urgent, rapidly evolving nature of the opioid crisis, where waiting could literally cost lives.
Yeah.
The DEA also determined this action isn't a significant regulatory action under executive orders, nor does it have major federalism implications, further emphasizing its targeted immediate focus on public safety.
So what's the key takeaway here for the ongoing fight against synthetic opioids and the government's ability to respond?
It really signifies the government's capacity for rapid response when faced with emerging drug threats. They're using specific legal tools, like this temporary scheduling order, to try and curb the spread of dangerous new substances on the recreational market as quickly as possible. It's a continuous, evolving battle. New compounds pop up, and the DEA has to use its most agile regulatory powers to try and stay ahead and protect communities.
Okay, moving on. Let's talk pensions. The Pension Benefit Guaranty Corporation, or PBGC, they play a vital role in protecting pension benefits for millions of Americans. We see a series of rules here. They seem like detailed administrative adjustments. What's the overarching theme, and how do these changes impact pension plan stability?
Right. These rules, which are effective immediately, August 15th, are primarily about clarifying existing regulations and also conforming them to recent statutory changes, things introduced by, for example, the SECURE Act and also the Bipartisan Budget Act of 2015, big pieces of legislation affecting retirement plans. So the overarching theme is really about ensuring smooth operation, compliance, and ultimately the long-term stability of pension plans across the country, adapting them to the current legislative landscape.
Okay. Can you give us an example of one of these adjustments?
Sure. First, they're updating the definition of new plan. So a new plan will now mean a plan with an effective date during the premium payment year. This change was needed because the SECURE Act allows employers to retroactively adopt new plans during the prior tax year.
Ah, okay. So the old definition didn't quite fit anymore.
Exactly. This simplifies how these newly adopted plans calculate and pay their premiums to the PBGC. Makes the process align better with current tax law and how businesses actually operate now. Second, regarding the termination of single employer plans, the rules clarify the process for voluntarily ending plans that have sufficient assets to cover benefits. This includes things like required participant notifications, providing detailed benefit information, and filing specific data with the PBGC before they can distribute the assets, just making sure the wind-down process is orderly and transparent. And there's an important detail for plan administrators here. For plan years starting in 2025, premium filings are actually due a month earlier than usual, the 15th day of the ninth calendar month.
What it's changed?
That's a specific provision from the Bipartisan Budget Act of 2015. It supersedes the standard rules, as the PBGC highlighted in a technical update. Just one of those statutory changes they have to implement. Third, the reportable events regulation is amended. The PBGC no longer requires notice if there's a change in a contributing sponsor, if that change doesn't result in the sponsor ceasing to be part of the plan's controlled group.
Meaning
if the overall corporate structure backing the plan hasn't fundamentally changed in a way that increases risk, they don't need that specific piece of paperwork anymore. Reduces an unnecessary reporting burden. Fourth, there are conforming changes related to allocation of assets and duties following mass withdrawal. These stem from a prior rule update back in June that changed interest and mortality assumptions. This rule just cleans up some related terminology. And finally, a minor but, you know, crucial correction to the special financial assistance by PBGC regulation. They fixed an erroneous reference to an ERISA section. Accuracy in legal citations is paramount, right?
Absolutely. So, summing up these PBGC changes, what's the core insight for someone involved with or benefiting from a pension plan?
It signifies the continuous effort to refine and clarify pension regulations. While many of these are quite technical, almost administrative cleanup, they're absolutely essential for ensuring the stability and proper administration of pension plans. Ultimately, it's about safeguarding the benefits for millions of Americans who rely on these plans for retirement. And the PBGC certifies these changes won't have a significant economic impact on small entities, as they are primarily clarifications.
Okay, next up, we have a special local regulation for the Department of Homeland Security, the Coast Guard, specific to a body of water, Casco Bay in Maine, near Cow Island. What's prompted the Coast Guard to issue this, and what kind of restrictions are we talking about?
Right. The Coast Guard is setting up a temporary special local regulation. The purpose is to ensure safety during an offshore concert event, expected to involve a large number of spectator vessels gathering near Cow Island. So this is really a proactive crowd control measure, but on the water, trying to prevent collisions, manage traffic flow, ensure emergency access during a big public gathering.
When is this in effect?
The rule is technically effective from 12:30 p.m. Saturday, August 16th through 5:30 p.m. Sunday, August 17th, 2025. But, and this is key, it will only be enforced during specific hours on Saturday or potentially Sunday if bad weather delays the concert. So it's very event specific.
And what are the actual restrictions on the water?
Okay, so within the regulated area, which is designated as a spectator zone, swimming is completely prohibited. Makes sense. Lots of boats around. There's also a speed restriction, a no-wake zone established to keep the waters calm and safe. And critically, they've established two transit areas. Each is about 240 feet wide. One runs parallel to the concert stage barge, the other perpendicular. In these specific transit areas, stopping, fishing, mooring, anchoring, or just loitering is prohibited.
Why those restrictions?
To ensure clear access. For vessels that just need to pass through the area, and more importantly, for any emergency responders who might need quick, unimpeded access to the scene, the notice provides the specific coordinates for the regulated area, too, based on the North American Datum, 1983. Very precise.
Even that this event is happening, well, basically, no. The rule became effective very quickly, less than 30 days after publication. How did they manage that rapid implementation?
The Coast Guard cited what's known as good cause under the Administrative Procedure Act. They stated that delaying the effective date would be impracticable because, basically, the rule had to be in effect by August 16th to serve its purpose, public safety, during the event. Waiting longer would defeat the whole point.
Right.
It really demonstrates the agility needed for these kinds of event-specific safety protocols. The Coast Guard also notes the rule aligns with federalism principles, has no tribal implications. It's temporary, highly localized, but vital for safety in a dynamic marine environment during a big event.
So bottom line, what does this mean for you if you're a boater or planning to be out on Casco Bay this weekend?
It means be acutely aware of this temporary but significant change to navigation and activity rules in that specific area around Cow Island during the concert times. Prioritize safety, know the restrictions, the no wake zone, the no stopping transit lanes, no swimming. Following the rules is crucial for everyone to enjoy what sounds like a pretty unique offshore event safely. Always good to check the local notices to mariners, too.
Okay, let's shift gears to the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA. They've issued a rule extending deadlines for public comments on some major environmental standards. These affect several key industries. What's behind this extension?
Right. This rule extends the public comment period for proposed standards that impact the oil and natural gas sector climate review, integrated iron and steel manufacturing facilities, and also emissions guidelines for coke ovens. These are significant regulations. They deal with things like greenhouse gas emissions, hazardous air pollutants from major industrial sources. So big economic and environmental implications.
And why the extension? Just more time needed.
It's directly linked to another even bigger proposed rule, the reconsideration of 2009 endangerment finding and greenhouse gas vehicle standards. That's a foundational piece of climate regulation. The public hearing for that rule was initially set for 2 days, August 19th and 20th. But the EPA decided to add a third day, August 21st, and they're even considering adding a fourth, August 22nd.
Okay, but why would adding hearing days for that rule push back the comment deadline for these other rules on oil, gas, steel? That seems a bit indirect.
It might seem indirect, but it's actually a direct legal requirement under the Clean Air Act, Section 7607D5. The law requires that the official record for public comment and oral presentations remains open for 30 days after the completion of the proceeding.
Ah, so extending the hearing dates physically shifts the completion date.
Exactly. Since the EPA extended the public hearing for the big endangerment finding rule by at least 1 day, the official completion of the proceeding also shifted later. This means the comment period for these related rules, the oil and gas, steel, coke ovens, which was initially set to end on September 15th, is now legally required to be extended. It moves to September 22nd, 2025. The impact is that it ensures the public and affected industries have ample time to submit rebuttal info, supplementary data, things like that, following those expanded public hearings. It reflects a commitment to a thorough, inclusive public engagement process, especially for these high-stakes environmental regulations, even if it adds a bit more time to the overall process.
Okay, still with the EPA, but moving from industrial emissions to, well, our food plates. The EPA also has a rule here about something called mandipropamid and setting a pesticide tolerance. What's this about, and how does it affect the food we might eat?
Right. This is a final rule. It establishes a legal limit, which is called a tolerance, for residues of the pesticide mandipropamid, specifically in or on papaya. A company, Syngenta Crop Protection, submitted the petition asking for this tolerance level to be set.
And what is the level?
The tolerance is set at 0.9 parts per million, or ppm, on papaya. This rule is effective immediately, August 15th. Though, like with many rules, objections and requests for hearings can still be filed for a while until October 14th, 2025, allows for continued public input or challenges.
How does the EPA determine that this specific level, 0.9 ppm, is actually safe for consumers, especially thinking about, you know, kids or other sensitive groups?
That's governed by the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, the FFDCA. It sets a really high bar. The EPA can establish a tolerance only if they determine there is a reasonable certainty that no harm will result from aggregate exposure.
Aggregate exposure, meaning?
Meaning, They look at the total exposure from all sources. Dietary exposure from eating the food, yes, but also potential exposure through drinking water, and even exposure in residential settings, like from home pesticide use. They don't include occupational exposure in this calculation, though. And a really crucial aspect, particularly relevant to you, our listener, is the Food Quality Protection Act safety factor, the FQPA factor. For infants and children, the FFDCA requires EPA to apply an additional tenfold margin of safety to NEX for what they call threshold effects, unless there's really reliable data supporting a different factor.
So an extra safety buffer specifically for kids.
Exactly. It accounts for potential vulnerabilities during development, any gaps in toxicity data. In this specific case for manipropamid, the EPA determined it didn't have a common mechanism of toxicity with other substances, which simplifies the risk assessment slightly. So the impact. This rule directly affects the papaya industry. It ensures the papayas we buy and eat meet these stringent safety standards for pesticide residues. It really illustrates the scientific and regulatory rigor that goes into our food safety net. The detailed process of evaluating these substances before they can be present in our food supply, even at very low levels.
Okay, finally for our rules section today, we turn to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the NRC. They have an interim enforcement policy for nuclear facilities. That definitely sounds like a big deal. An agency like the NRT adjusting how it enforces rules in nuclear power plants.
It is, it's a very specific, but yes, undeniably important regulatory adjustment. This interim enforcement policy, or IEP, provides the NRC with what they call enforcement discretion. This discretion applies to certain violations committed by a nuclear power plant operator who they call a general licensee when those violations are related to their adoption of a change that was generated by the certificate of compliance holder.
Okay, unpack that a bit. Who is the certificate of compliance holder, and why would the NRC need discretion, especially for nuclear safety, where you'd think rules are ironclad?
Right. So the certificate of compliance, or COSI holder, is typically a vendor or a supplier, someone who designs or manufactures equipment or modifies designs for nuclear facilities. They hold the certificate saying their product or design meets certain standards. The reason for discretion? Well, it recognizes the practical complexities and the highly interconnected nature of the nuclear industry. When one of these suppliers makes changes to their certified products or designs, the nuclear power plant operator, the licensee, then has to adopt those changes into their facility, integrate them. This policy allows the NRC some flexibility. They can apply discretion rather than immediately jumping to a rigid enforcement action if the operator's violation is, say, a minor specific administrative or procedural issue that comes directly from the adoption of that supplier-generated change.
So it distinguishes between the operator making a mistake themselves versus an issue arising from implementing someone else's design change.
Exactly. It differentiates between, say, a fundamental safety lapse on the operator's part versus a compliance hiccup stemming directly from integrating an external design modification. This policy is effective August 15th. It aims to streamline the process for licensees to safely integrate modifications and improvements from their suppliers without facing maybe disproportionate penalties for minor administrative missteps that happen during that adoption process. Ultimately, the idea is to foster a more adaptive and secure nuclear energy landscape by balancing that absolutely essential strict oversight with some practical flexibility needed for ongoing technological upgrades and safety enhancements. So it's a nuanced tool. It illustrates how the NRC balances its strict oversight role with practical flexibility to ensure ongoing safety and operational efficiency in a very, very highly regulated industry.
All right, now we move into proposed rules. This is where we get a glimpse of what federal agencies are considering, what might be coming down the pipeline. First one here is from the Department of Commerce National Marine Fisheries Service, NMFS. It sounds intriguing, maybe a little alarming at first glance. Incidental take authorization for harbor fields during a restoration project. Tell us more.
Yeah, this proposal by NMFS is to authorize what's called Level B harassment of harbor seals. This would happen during construction activities for the Duckabush Estuary Restoration Project, they call it DRRP, in Washington State. This request actually came from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, the USEE, who are doing the restoration work.
Okay, Level B harassment. That sounds potentially bad. What does it actually mean in this context? Are seals being harmed?
That's a really important clarification. In this context, under the Marine Mammal Protection Act, Level B harassment primarily refers to things like visual disturbance and in-air noise from the construction, things that might cause the seals to temporarily change their behavior, like maybe moving away from the construction area, or if they're hauled out on land, flushing into the water. Crucially, the proposal states that no injuries or mortalities are anticipated or proposed to be authorized. The whole point of the authorization and the mitigation measures is to minimize disturbance, not permit actual harm.
Got it. So what's the backstory on this Duckabush Estuary project? Why is restoration needed, and why are these impacts on harbor seals expected? Seems like an odd mix.
Well, the Duckabush Estuary's natural functions were pretty significantly disrupted way back in the early 1900s. Road and bridge construction, particularly when Highway 101 basically cut right through the estuary back in 1934.
Ah, okay. Infrastructure versus nature.
Right. This construction messed up the natural tidal circulation. It impeded fish access to vital salt marsh habitats. Those are crucial nursery areas for many species. And over time, this led to a decline in the valuable mudflats and salt marshes. The ecosystem suffered. So the DRP, this restoration project, aims to fix that, to restore those critical ecological functions, bring the estuary back to a more natural, healthy state.
And the seals? Why expect construction to bother them?
Well, studies have shown that harbor seals can be pretty sensitive to human activity. Even relatively quiet things, like a stopped powerboat or even kayaks nearby, can sometimes cause them to flush into the water from their haul-out spots. So construction noise and activity, even if mostly land-based, is expected to cause some temporary behavioral changes. While they think direct mother-pup separation from the noise is unlikely here, seals might temporarily relocate to other undisturbed areas nearby if they find the construction too disruptive. And that behavioral change, that temporary move or flush, that's what constitutes the Level B harassment that NMFS is considering authorizing.
This raises a tricky question. How do they even estimate how many seals might be taken, meaning harassed in this way, especially if direct observations might be limited?
That's a good point, because there's limited historical survey data specifically for harbor seals at the Duckabush River estuary. NMFS used a statistical approach, a basic linear model.
A linear model. How does that work?
Think of it like drawing a straight line between known data points. If they have actual seal counts from observations on two different dates, the model estimates the number of seals for all the days in between by assuming a steady linear increase or decrease.
So basically connecting the dots.
Kind of, yeah. It's a way to estimate daily presence when you don't have daily observations. For instance, if they saw 99 seals on August 27th and 130 on September 21st, the model would estimate, say, 100.24 seals on August 28th and so on, filling in the gaps. Using this method, the highest number of estimated Level B harassment takes, meaning instances of seals being disturbed projected for any single year of the project, is 480 in 2027. It provides a systematic, the simplified way to quantify potential impacts even when you have sparse direct data.
Okay, so they anticipate some disturbance. What mitigation measures are being proposed by the Army Corps and required by NMFS to minimize the actual impact on the seals during this restoration work?
Mitigation is absolutely central to this whole proposal. The goal is always the least practicable adverse impact. A key point is that most of the construction work will be land-based, which itself reduces direct interaction with the marine environment where the seals are. But beyond that, key measures include requiring qualified NMFS-approved protected species observers, PSOs. And these PSOs have to be independent of the construction contractor, ensuring objectivity.
What do the PSOs do?
They monitor the construction area for 30 minutes before any activity starts, and also during and for 30 minutes after it stops each day. They establish shutdown zones. If a marine mammal, like a seal, enters that zone, the construction activity has to stop until the animal leaves. And there are also specific, stricter rules during the harbor seal pupping season, which runs from August 1st through October 31st. During pupping season, construction cannot even be initiated if it's within 300 meters of a mom pup pair hauled out on land, or within 100 meters of a mom pup pair in the water. Provides a crucial buffer during that really vulnerable time for the young seals. NMFS bases its preliminary negligible impact determination on the belief that these disturbances will be localized, temporary, and unlikely to adversely affect the harbor seal population's overall annual rates of recruitment or survival. And importantly, in the long run, the restoration project itself is expected to have a net beneficial effect on the seal's habitat. By improving the estuary, it could increase prey availability, improve water quality, and generally enhance the ecological function of the SLEO, creating a healthier environment for the seals and other wildlife.
So stepping back, what does this proposed rule mean for you, our listener, and maybe for how we think about marine conservation efforts that have to balance human activities and wildlife needs?
Well, it's a really compelling example of that balancing act, isn't it? balancing necessary infrastructure work, in this case, ecological restoration, which is ultimately good with the need to protect wildlife. It highlights the rigorous, detailed process involved in assessing potential environmental impacts, even impacts like temporary behavioral changes, and then implementing specific concrete mitigation measures like the PSOs, the shutdown zones, the seasonal restrictions to try and achieve conservation goals alongside necessary human activities. It shows that even beneficial projects like restoration can have temporary impacts that need careful management and oversight.
All right, let's move into the final major section, notices. These are generally public information announcements, requests for comments, or documentation of agency actions. First notice comes from the Department of Agriculture, the Foreign Agricultural Service. It's about an adjustment of appendices under the Dairy Tariff Rate Quota Import Licensing Regulation. What's changing with dairy import licenses?
Okay. This notice, effective August 15th, announces that certain quantities or amounts for specific dairy articles are being transferred. They're moving from the historical license category, which is listed in Appendix 1 of the regulation, over to the lottery non-historical license category in Appendix 2. This is for the 2025 quota year.
Okay, so what does that actually mean? Why shift import quotas from a historical system to a lottery system?
It fundamentally changes who gets the valuable licenses to import certain dairy products into the U.S. at a lower tariff rate. Under the tariff rate quota system, there is a certain amount you can import at a low tariff, and imports above that face a much higher tariff. The historical licenses, as the name suggests, traditionally favored importers who had a proven track record. Basically, companies that had imported these products in the past got first dibs, or a guaranteed allocation based on their history.
So it rewarded established players.
Exactly. Shifting quantities to a lottery system opens up the opportunity to get these low tariff licenses to potentially new entrants or maybe smaller businesses that don't have that long import history. Everyone in the lottery pool has an equal chance. This whole process is administered under specific federal regulations, 7 CFR parts 6.0 through 6.36. The impact. Well, it could subtly shift the competitive dynamics within the dairy import market, might diversify the pool of importers, and maybe, just maybe, affect the variety and pricing of certain imported dairy products available to you, the consumer. It's a move towards potentially leveling the playing field for access to these quotas.
Okay, next we have a few notices from the Department of Commerce, all related to trade enforcement and compliance. Seems like they've been busy with investigations into unfair import practices. What are the key findings here?
Yes, several trade determinations published today. First, Commerce made a final affirmative countervailing duty determination on Solgel alumina-based ceramic abrasive grains from China.
Countervailing duty, meaning subsidies.
Exactly. Commerce found that countervailable subsidies are being provided by the Chinese government to the producers and exporters of these specific abrasive grains. These aren't just any grains. They're highly specialized ceramic abrasives, mostly aluminum oxide, with very specific grain sizes used in things like grinding wheels or sandpaper. The finding means these producers are unfairly benefiting from government support, giving them an artificial advantage in the U.S. market.
So what happens now?
This determination will lead to the imposition of countervailing duties, basically import taxes designed to offset those subsidies and level the playing field for U.S. manufacturers. The next step is for the International Trade Commission, the ITC, to determine within 45 days if these subsidized imports are actually causing material injury to the U.S. domestic industry. If they find injury, the duties stick. Also noteworthy, the all others rate for companies not individually examined was set using facts otherwise available, which usually implies some lack of cooperation from those exporters.
Okay, what's the second trade case?
Second, a final affirmative anti-dumping duty determination, an affirmative final determination of critical circumstances concerning overhead door springs from China.
Dumping in critical circumstances, that sounds serious.
It is. Dumping means Commerce confirmed these springs are being sold in the U.S. at less than fair value, essentially below their cost or home market price. But the critical circumstances finding is also really significant. It implies that Commerce found evidence of unusually large volumes of these springs being imported in a short period after the investigation started.
Like they were trying to rush imports in before duties hit.
That's the implication, yes. An attempt to circumvent the potential duties. Because of this finding, for the main China-wide entity, the collection of estimated duties will be applied retroactively, going back 90 days before the preliminary determination was published back in March.
Wow, so duties can apply to imports that already arrived months ago.
Correct. It makes the measure much more immediately impactful. The scope covers steel torsion springs used in overhead garage doors, including associated hardware if imported together. Again, the ITC now has 45 days to make its injury determination, and again, facts available were used for setting some rates.
And the third trade notice from Commerce.
Third, we have the preliminary results of an anti-dumping duty administrative review for certain steel wire garment hangers from China.
An administrative review. So this is for an existing order.
Exactly. This isn't a new case, but a periodic review to calculate the actual dumping margins for specific importers during a past period. For specific companies named, like DJAC and Ningxia Huawei, the estimated dumping margins were calculated at $1.41 and $1.34/kilogram, respectively. Other companies that cooperated but weren't individually reviewed received a rate based on the reviewed companies, $1.34/kilogram. Importantly, the China-wide entity, which applies to exporters who didn't prove independence from government control or didn't cooperate, maintains its much higher rate of $2.42/kilogram. Companies that failed to file the right paperwork are lumped into this higher rate.
So what's the core takeaway from these multiple trade actions today?
They really highlight the ongoing detailed work by the U.S. government to enforce trade laws and protect domestic industries from what it determines are unfair practices like dumping and illegal subsidies. Whether it's specialized abrasives, common garage door springs, or everyday clothes hangers, these actions aim to ensure U.S. manufacturers can compete fairly. They affect import prices, supply chains, and the competitiveness of domestic alternatives. It's a continuous monitoring and enforcement process in global trade.
All right, let's turn to the Department of Defense, DD, and specifically the Department of the Army. There's a notice about a final environmental impact statement, FEIS, for the Military Ocean Terminal Sunny Point, MOTSU, in North Carolina. What significant actions are being evaluated there, and what's the purpose of MOTSU?
Right. The Army has announced the availability of the final EIS for proposed actions at MOTSU. This facility is incredibly important. It's the Military Surface Deployment and Distribution Command's main East Coast strategic ammunition port, vital for shipping munitions and supporting global military operations.
So very critical infrastructure. What are they proposing to do there?
The proposed actions, planned for fiscal years 2026 through 2031, cover a whole range of improvements and upgrades. Things like improving barricade safety around explosive storage, waterfront maintenance, enhancing security in what's called the Pleasure Island Explosive Safety Clear Zone. Also, upgrades to linear infrastructure roads, rail lines, utilities, fire breaks, plus stormwater mitigation and some infilling in the main cantonment area. Basically, it's all aimed at addressing critical mission requirements, ensuring the facility can operate safely and efficiently, and meeting all the relevant federal, state, DOD, and Army standards for handling ammunition.
Okay, now the notice mentions something called a final finding of no practicable alternative, FONPA. Why is that particular procedural detail significant, especially for a military base?
Yes, the FNPA. That's a key element under environmental law, specifically related to executive orders on floodplain management and protection of wetlands. A FNPA is prepared when proposed actions are located in environmentally sensitive areas, specifically floodplains or wetlands, and the agency determines, after analysis, that there are no practical alternative that would completely avoid impacts to these areas while still meeting the project's essential objectives.
So it basically says, we looked, but there's no other feasible way to do this crucial work without impacting these sensitive areas, so we're documenting why.
Precisely. It acknowledges potential environmental impacts in those specific areas, but legally affirms the necessity of the chosen path for mission success. It's a required step when building in floodplains or wetlands is unavoidable for a critical federal action. The overall impact of this FES is to ensure that these vital military infrastructure upgrades and maintenance activities proceed only after a full environmental review, attempting to balance those crucial operational needs for national security with environmental stewardship responsibilities. And just quickly, there's also a routine administrative notice from the DOD about their information collection activities under the Paperwork Reduction Act. They've submitted a proposal to OMB for clearance, seeking public comments until September 15th. Standard procedure ensuring transparency and minimizing paperwork burden.
Okay, let's move over to the Department of Education, ED. First notice concerns Student Assistance General Provisions Non-Title III Revenue Requirements, which is often called the 90-10 rule. What exactly is this rule and what's happening with it in this notice?
Right. This notice is from Federal Student Aid, or FSA. They're proposing an extension without change of a currently approved information collection request. So it's mostly administrative paperwork renewal. But The 90-10 rule itself is a really significant federal regulation. It primarily affects for-profit colleges and universities.
How so? What does it require?
It mandates that these institutions must derive at least 10% of their total revenue from sources other than federal student aid programs. Those are the Title IV funds, like Pell Grants and federal student loans. So at least 10% has to come from things like private student loans, institutional scholarships, direct payments from students or employers, maybe military benefits like the GI Bill now count towards the 10% under recent changes.
And the purpose of that rule?
It's fundamentally a measure designed to ensure that these for-profit schools have some level of market viability and accountability beyond just relying on federal student aid dollars. The idea is if they can't attract at least 10% of their revenue from non-federal sources, maybe the education they offer isn't valued enough in the open market. So while this specific notice is just administrative extending the collection of the data needed to enforce the rule, the 90-10 rule itself is a crucial tool for oversight. It aims to protect both students and taxpayers from institutions that might be overly dependent on federal funds and potentially not delivering good educational outcomes. Comments on this extension request are invited until October 14th.
Okay, another notice from the Department of Education, this time regarding the Integrated Post-Secondary Education Data System, or IPEs. What's the change or update here concerning IPEs data collection?
This notice is from the National Center for Education Statistics, NCES, which runs IPEDS. They're proposing a revision of their currently approved information collection requests for the IPEDS data. IPEDS is huge. It's a comprehensive system that collects a vast amount of data from essentially all post-secondary institutions in the U.S., colleges, universities, technical schools. It covers areas like enrollment, graduation rates, program completions, faculty characteristics, institutional finances, student financial aid. Tons of stuff.
So what are they proposing to revise?
They're specifically seeking public feedback on the anticipated time burden for institutions. How long does it actually take schools to compile and submit all the required data elements for IPEDS? They're also looking for ways to enhance the quality, utility, and clarity of the information collected. Is the data useful? Is it clear? And importantly, they want input on how to minimize the reporting burden on these institutions, potentially through using technology better or streamlining the collection process.
Why is this IPEDS data so important?
Oh, it's fundamental. It's used by prospective students and families choosing schools through tools like the College Scorecard. It's used by researchers analyzing trends in higher education. It's used by policymakers developing educational programs and allocating resources. So ensuring the data is accurate, relevant, timely, and collected as efficiently as possible is really vital for informed decision making across the entire education sector. Comments on these proposed revisions are due by October 14th, 2025.
Okay, from the Department of Energy, we have the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, a notice about records governing off-the-record communications. That phrase, off-the-record communications, sounds a bit cloak and dagger, maybe hinting at backroom deals. What does it actually mean in a regulatory context like FERC's?
Yeah, it can sound a bit mysterious, but in a formal regulatory proceeding, like deciding whether to approve a new pipeline or power line, off-the-record communications simply means discussions or submissions that happen outside the official, publicly accessible case file or record. This notice actually serves as a transparency mechanism. FERC is publicly acknowledging the receipt of certain communications related to a specific project, docket number CP25535-000 is referenced, that were received off the record. They categorize these into prohibited and exempt communications.
What's the difference?
Prohibited communications are generally those that are not supposed to happen off the record, especially communications on the merits of the case between decision makers and interested parties without other parties present. FRC typically does not consider these in reaching its decisions, precisely to ensure fairness and prevent undue influence from private, unrecorded discussions. However, the notice mentions that parties can request an opportunity to respond to a prohibited communication and potentially have it placed into the official record if fairness dictates it's necessary. Exempt communications, on the other hand, are those allowed under specific FRRC rules, often for more routine procedural or administrative matters that don't go to the substance of the case.
So the impact of this notice?
It reinforces the integrity and impartiality of FERC's decision-making process, especially for these complex and often contentious energy projects. It assures the public and all parties involved that decisions are supposed to be made based on the information presented in the formal public record, not through hidden channels. Transparency is key. The notice also points out that public comments or protests for this specific project are due by September 2nd, 2025, and FRRC's Office of Public Participation is available to help people navigate the process. Okay, next, another one from the Environmental Protection Agency. This notice under the Toxic Substances Control Act, TSCA, is titled Certain New Chemicals or Significant New Uses, Statements of Findings, June 2025. This is basically the EPA informing the public about findings it made during the month of June 2025. Specifically, the EPA determined after review that certain new chemical substances or proposed significant new uses of existing chemicals are not likely to present an unreasonable risk of injury to health or the environment.
How do they make that determination?
It's based on their scientific review of various submissions they receive from chemical manufacturers or importers. Things like pre-manufacture notices, PMNs for brand new chemicals, microbial commercial activity notices, MCNs, for microorganisms, and significant new use notices, SNUNs, when someone wants to use an existing chemical in a major new way. This is a routine but absolutely critical step in the EPA's process of regulating chemicals before they enter commerce or are used broadly in new ways. It highlights the proactive measures required under TSCA to assess and manage potential risks, ensuring public health and environmental safety. All right, moving on to the Federal Reserve System. A notice regarding formations of, acquisitions by, and mergers of bank holding companies. This is essentially the Fed informing the public about applications that have been submitted to the Board of Governors for approval.
What kind of applications?
They involve companies seeking to become bank holding companies, or existing bank holding companies seeking to acquire the assets, ownership, or control of other banks or bank holding companies. This can also include acquiring their non-banking subsidiaries. These approvals are a core part of the Federal Reserve's oversight responsibilities for the banking sector. They review these applications to ensure that such formations, acquisitions, or mergers promote overall financial stability, maintain healthy competition within the banking sector, meet the needs of the community served, and, of course, comply with all the relevant laws and regulations like the Bank Holding Company Act of 1956. It's a fundamental piece of how the banking landscape is shaped and supervised.
Okay, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, has a notice about its Vessel Sanitation Program, VSP, and the associated inspection fees. This sounds like it directly impacts cruise ship safety and public health for travelers, right?
You're absolutely right. This notice from the CDC announces that the vessel sanitation inspection fees that were put in place for fiscal year 2025 will continue into FY 2026 until further notice. These fees are vital because they directly fund the CDC's Vessel Sanitation Program, the VSP.
And what does the VSP do?
It plays a really crucial role in public health. It helps the cruise line industry develop and implement comprehensive sanitation programs on board their ships. The goal is to minimize the risk of gastrointestinal illnesses, like norovirus outbreaks and other environmentally associated health hazards. Every cruise vessel that carries 13 or more passengers and has a foreign itinerary calling on a U.S. port is subject to the VSP. This includes twice yearly unannounced operations inspections conducted by VSP staff, and if necessary, re-inspections if a ship fails an inspection.
Unannounced inspections, twice a year. That sounds pretty thorough.
It is. This program is vital for protecting the health of the millions of passengers who take cruises each year, as well as the crew members. The continuation of these fees ensures the VSP has the resources to maintain its crucial oversight and keep those standards high. Quick one here from HUD, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, a correction notice. It specifically corrects an earlier notice from August 5th, 2025. That earlier notice dealt with compliance dates for new carbon monoxide detection and smoke alarm requirements within the Housing Opportunities for Persons with AIDS, OPUA program. This correction just ensures clarity and accuracy regarding those compliance deadlines. It emphasizes the importance of accurate regulatory guidance, especially when it concerns critical life safety standards for housing units serving a vulnerable population.
Okay, also from HUD, they're announcing a high-value loan sale, designated HVLS 2025-3. This involves selling off mortgage loans. What's unique or particularly notable about this specific sale?
Right. HUD is selling a portfolio of mortgage loans it holds. The key things to note are that these loans will be sold without FHA insurance and with servicing released.
What does servicing released mean?
It means the buyer of the loan portfolio takes over the responsibility for collecting payments, managing escrow accounts, handling customer service, and dealing with delinquencies or foreclosures. HUD washes its hands of the day-to-day management.
And no FHA insurance.
Correct. That means the buyer assumes the full credit risk. If the borrower defaults, the buyer bears the loss, not the FHA insurance fund. This makes these sales different from selling FHA-insured loans. The bidding process is detailed in a bidding information package, or BIP, a really key detail here. The legal agreements for the sale, the conveyance, assignment, and assumption agreements are non-negotiable. And notably, these agreements do not contain what are sometimes called first look requirements or specific mission outcome goals.
Meaning what?
Meaning this sale appears to be structured as a pure financial transaction aimed at liquidating these assets efficiently for HUD. It's distinct from other HUD asset sales that might prioritize selling to nonprofits or entities committed to achieving specific affordable housing or community development outcomes. Those often have first look periods or specific requirements built in. There are also strict eligibility criteria for potential bidders. They have to disclose key personnel, parent companies, subsidiaries, etc. And they're ineligible if they or related parties have defaulted on federal debt, are barred from federal contracts, or even knowingly employ certain HUD Office of Housing employees, ensures fairness and prevents conflicts of interest. So, the impact. This sale reflects HUD's ongoing role in managing and liquidating its portfolio of mortgage assets. It affects the secondary mortgage market and determines who will be servicing these specific loans going forward.
Okay, this next notice from HUD is, well, it's huge. It takes up dozens of pages in today's Federal Register. It lists hundreds and hundreds of organizations across the entire country receiving Continuum of Care COSI program grants for fiscal year 2023.
Mm.
What exactly is the COSI program, and what does the sheer scale of this announcement tell us?
The Continuum of Care program is HUD's primary federal initiative aimed squarely at addressing homelessness. It provides competitive grant funding to local communities, often through regional planning bodies called COSIs all across the U.S. This funding supports a really wide range of services and housing options designed to form a continuum of care. It includes things like emergency shelters for immediate crisis needs, transitional housing programs to help people stabilize, permanent supportive housing for individuals and families with long-term disabilities experiencing chronic homelessness, and also rapid rehousing programs designed to quickly move people from homelessness into permanent housing with temporary support.
And the scale here is just massive, page after page of organizations.
Exactly. The sheer volume of this list, covering, as you said, numerous pages, powerfully demonstrates the national scope and the persistent challenge of homelessness in America. But it also shows the extensive federal investment and commitment to tackling it. You see organizations receiving funding in major cities like Houston, Seattle, Miami, but also in much smaller communities like Jackson, California, or Adel, Georgia. It highlights that homelessness is an issue affecting communities of all sizes. Award amounts vary widely, too, from relatively small grants in the tens of thousands up to multi-million dollar awards tailored to local needs, project types, and capacities. The impact is direct and profound. This funding supports local, on-the-ground efforts to provide shelter, housing, and critical supportive services like case management, mental health care, substance abuse treatment for individuals and families experiencing homelessness. The ultimate goal is to prevent and end homelessness across the country. It's a critical lifeline for many of our most vulnerable populations. And sticking with HUD grants, two other significant award announcements are also included in today's notices. First, the Choice Neighborhoods Implementation Grants for fiscal year 2023. This program is really focused on comprehensive neighborhood revitalization, not just fixing housing. Two cities received particularly large grants in FY23. The Chattanooga Housing Authority in Tennessee and the city of Huntsville, Alabama, each got $50 million. Huge investments. Other major cities like Houston, Miami, Syracuse, Trenton, Phoenix, and Shreveport are also listed as recipients.
And the goal of Choice Neighborhoods?
It's designed to transform areas with distressed public or HUD-assisted housing and the surrounding neighborhoods into thriving, sustainable, mixed-income communities. It takes a holistic approach, improving housing, yes, but also investing in services for residents like education and health, improving neighborhood amenities, and creating pathways to economic opportunity, revitalizing not just the physical structures, but the whole social and economic fabric. Second, there's the Resident Opportunity and Self-Sufficiency Service Coordinator Program, ROSSSC, grants for fiscal year 2022.
What do these service coordinators do?
This program provides funding specifically for service coordinators who work directly with residents living in public and HUD-assisted housing. Their primary role is to help these residents achieve greater economic self-sufficiency and improve their overall quality of life. They do this by connecting residents to vital community resources, things like job training programs, adult education, financial literacy classes, childcare assistance, transportation, healthcare services, whatever barriers residents face to achieving their goals. It's really about empowering individuals and families to transition from welfare to work, find better employment, increase their earnings, and improve their overall well-being, breaking cycles of poverty. This program is a crucial component of supporting low-income residents, focusing on providing comprehensive support that goes beyond just providing housing. The list of grantees again shows its broad reach across diverse communities, from Wadena, Minnesota to Goldsboro, North Carolina. Okay, moving to the Department of the Interior, specifically the U.S. Geological Survey, or USGS, there is a notice about their agency information collection activities, specifically proposals related to the Comprehensive Test Bend Treaty Mine Development and Mineral Exploration Supplement. This relates to the USGS's mandated activities under acts like the National Mining and Minerals Policy Act. They are required to collect, evaluate, and analyze information on mineral occurrence, production, consumption, and technology within the domestic mineral industry.
Why do they collect this data?
They use it to understand the nation's mineral posture. They report these findings to Congress, especially if they identify any potential crisis or significant issues in the domestic mining and minerals industries, things related to supply chain vulnerabilities, import reliance, etc. This specific collection involves forms like the Mineral Exploration Supplement, the Mine and Plant Development Supplement, and the Mineral Production Supplement. Companies provide this information voluntarily. USGS estimates it takes about 45 minutes per response, totaling around 243 annual burden hours across all respondents. The impact. This data is absolutely foundational for understanding the nation's mineral resources. It informs critical policy decisions related to national security, economic competitiveness, supply chain resilience, environmental management, and land use planning in the mining sector.
Okay, still within Interior, now the Bureau of Land Management, the BLM. A notice titled Call for Nominations and Comments for a Proposed Competitive Coal Lease Sale in the Eagle Butte Mine Area, Campbell County, Wyoming. What's the public's role here?
Right. The BLM is formally inviting public comments and also seeking nominations for tracts of land to be included in a proposed competitive coal lease sale. This specific proposal is for an area adjacent to the existing Eagle Butte Mine in the Powder River Basin of Wyoming, covering about 1,412 acres containing federal coal reserves. The public comments they're seeking relate specifically to factors that might affect BLM's determination of the fair market value, FMV, of the coal, and also the maximum economic recovery, MER, possible from the lease.
Why is that important?
FMV and MER are critical concepts in federal leasing. BLM is required by law to ensure taxpayers receive fair market value for publicly owned resources like coal. MER relates to maximizing the amount of the resource recovered in an economically and environmentally sound manner. Public input is sought to ensure BLM has all relevant information, geological data, market conditions, potential environmental impacts, community concerns before they finalize the lease terms and conduct the sale. It's a crucial part of ensuring responsible management of public lands and resources and ensuring the government gets fair compensation, transparency, and accountability. Next up, the U.S. International Trade Commission, the ITC. A notice about the institution of anti-dumping and countervailing duty investigations concerning certain rayon staple fiber from China and India. The ITC has officially kicked off investigations into imports of this specific type of fiber, rayon staple fiber, from both China and India.
What prompted this?
These investigations were launched literally just a few days ago in response to petitions filed on August 12, 2025, by domestic U.S. producers of rayon staple fiber. They allege that imports from China and India are being unfairly traded.
Unfairly traded how?
Through both dumping, meaning sold in the U.S. at less than fair market value, and through countervailable subsidies provided by the governments of China and India. This notice marks the critical first step in the process. The ITC will now conduct a preliminary investigation to determine if there is a reasonable indication that the U.S. domestic industry is being materially injured or threatened with material injury by these allegedly dumped and subsidized imports. The Department of Commerce will simultaneously conduct its own investigations into the extent of dumping and subsidies. The outcome could be significant import duties on rayon staple fiber from these countries, which would directly impact the U.S. textile and nonwoven manufacturing sectors that use these fibers as raw material. The notice sets some very tight deadlines for submissions, indicating the swift pace of these initial investigation phases.
Okay, now to the Department of Justice, or DOJ. First, a notice from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, the ATF. It's about information collection for National Firearms Act, NFA forms. What does this mean for firearms enthusiasts, manufacturers, dealers, or anyone involved with NFA-regulated items?
Right. The ATF is requesting public comments on an existing information collection package related to various forms required under the National Firearms Act, or NFA. This is part of a routine process mandated by the Paperwork Reduction Act. Federal agencies have to periodically justify their information collections and seek public input on the burden they impose.
Who does this collection affect?
It affects a wide range of entities. State, local, and tribal governments, private sector businesses like manufacturers and dealers, individuals, and even other federal agencies sometimes. Basically, anyone who deals with NFA firearms. The notice states that response is required to retain a benefit, meaning if you want to legally manufacture, transfer, possess, or transport an NFA firearm, you generally have to fill out the relevant ATF forms.
And what kind of scale are we talking about?
The numbers are pretty notable. ATF estimates nearly 750,000 respondents annually across all the various NFA forms. With each response taking, on average, about 12 minutes, that totals up to almost 150,000 annual burden hours. It gives you a real sense of the extensive regulation and record-keeping involved with the NFA, which covers specific categories of firearms like machine guns, short-barreled rifles and shotguns, suppressors, silencers, and destructive devices. The impact is that this information collection is essential for ATF to ensure compliance with federal firearms regulations, track these specific types of firearms, and support public safety and law enforcement efforts.
Okay, this next notice from the Department of Justice seems potentially very broad and quite impactful. It's a request for information, RFI, from the Advisory Committee on State Laws Affecting Commerce. They're asking for information on state laws significantly and adversely affecting the national economy or interstate commerce. That sounds like the federal government looking very closely at state-level policymaking.
It certainly does. This is a formal call for public comments from businesses, trade associations, academics, state officials, the general public on state-level laws that are perceived by commenters to be creating significant negative impacts on the overall national economy or unduly hindering commerce between states.
So they're looking for examples of problematic state laws.
Yes. And importantly, the DOJ isn't just asking for complaints. They are also actively soliciting suggested solutions to address the adverse effects these state laws might be causing. What could be done about them?
What's the potential impact of an RFI like this?
Well, an RFI itself doesn't change any laws, but it signals a strong federal interest in identifying and potentially addressing regulatory inconsistencies or barriers at the state level that might be impeding economic growth, creating inefficiencies, or unfairly burdening businesses operating across state lines. Depending on the information received, it could lead to future actions, maybe policy recommendations from the advisory committee, perhaps legal challenges by the DOJ under the Constitution's Commerce Clause, or even proposals for federal legislation aimed at preempting certain state laws to promote a more uniform, cohesive national marketplace. It's definitely one to watch. Comments are due by September 15th, 2025.
Okay, back to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the NRC, one more time today. This is a notice announcing the availability of the final Supplemental Environmental Impact Statement, SEIS, related to the NextEra Energy Point Beach LLC, Point Beach Nuclear Plant, Units 1 and 2. What's the critical decision being addressed here?
Right. The NRC has published its final SEIS. This document is a key part of the environmental review process for the proposed subsequent license renewal for the Point Beach Nuclear Plant's Units 1 and 2, located in Wisconsin.
Subsequent license renewal, meaning extending their operating life again.
Exactly. Nuclear plants were initially licensed for 40 years. Most have received an initial 20-year license renewal. Subsequent license renewal allows them to apply to operate for another 20 years beyond that, so potentially up to 80 years total.
Wow. And this SUSES is part of that process for Point Beach.
Yes. The plant is located on the western shore of Lake Michigan, a significant source of power for the region. This final SUSES documents the NRC staff's environmental review. It addresses all the public comments received on the earlier draft reports, including comments from other agencies like the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. It shows the thoroughness of the environmental review. The notice mentions the second draft SEIS was published back in April, with comments ending in June.
What's the impact of extending a nuclear plant's license like this?
It has profound implications. On the one hand, it potentially ensures a large source of reliable, carbon-free electricity for the region for another two decades. Huge implications for energy supply and climate goals. On the other hand, it raises long-term questions about managing aging infrastructure, environmental impacts like the effects of cooling water discharge on Lake Michigan over 80 years, nuclear waste storage, and overall long-term nuclear safety. All of these are supposed to be evaluated in the SEIS and the separate safety evaluation report. This final SEIS essentially signifies the NRC's environmental clearance for this potential extended operation, paving the way for a final decision on the license renewal itself. And just a note on public engagement, while there are no immediate meetings scheduled specifically for this SIS, the NRC calendar does note a general public all-employees meeting scheduled for September 9th in Rockville, Maryland, highlighting the Commission's ongoing efforts of public outreach.
Okay, let's turn to the Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC. They always seem to have a flurry of notices about rule changes for financial markets. What are some of the key updates today?
Yes, quite a few filings related to exchanges and clearinghouses. First, NASDAQ Q Stock Market LLC and also NASDAQ BX Inc., that's NASDAQ Q's other exchange, have filed rule changes amending their options listing requirements for ETFs, exchange-traded funds.
What's a change?
They're essentially aligning their specific options listing rules more closely with the existing generic ETF shares listing standards that already exist. It clarifies that options on certain types of ETFs fall within the scope of existing interpretive policies, makes the rules more consistent and easier to understand.
And the impact?
The SEC granted these changes immediate effectiveness, waiving the usual 30-day waiting period. They found it was consistent with the protection of investors and the public interest and might result in more timely investment options and opportunities for market participants for trading and hedging using ETF options, basically keeping market rules clear, efficient, and up-to-date for popular products. Public comments are still open until September 5th, though. Next, the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, Inc., FINRA, that's the self-regulatory body overseeing brokerage firms and brokers, has filed a proposed rule change that will require parties involved in disciplinary hearings to use an Office of Hearing Officers portal.
A mandatory online portal.
Yes. This is a procedural but significant move towards digitizing and streamlining FINRA's dispute resolution process. Filing documents, accessing case information electronically. It's designed to improve efficiency, reduce paper, and enhance accessibility for all parties involved in these important disciplinary hearings. This rule also got immediate effectiveness, suggesting it's seen as a non-controversial administrative improvement. Then we have MIAX Pearl Equities amending its Exchange Rule 14, which deals with the series of options open for trading, specifically focusing on position and exercise limits.
Why are position limits important in options trading?
The SEC highlights this in the notice. These limits are crucial. They're designed to, quote, to prevent the establishment of options positions that can be used or might create incentives to manipulate or disrupt the underlying market, like the stock the option is based on. They also help minimize the potential for mini manipulations and for corners or squeezes of the underlying market and reduce potential disruption of the options market itself, especially in illiquid options classes. So, fundamental rules for maintaining fair and orderly markets, comments are open until September 5th. Similarly, Vioxx Exchange LLC filed a proposed rule change to amend its risk protection framework, known as BX Rule 1210. This type of rule is critical for market stability. It outlines automated mechanisms and procedures exchanges use to protect against things like significant market disruptions, operational errors by trading firms like fat finger trades, or traders taking on excessive risk. Enhancing these frameworks is an ongoing process. Again, immediate effectiveness suggests it's viewed as a non-controversial enhancement to market safeguards. Comments also due September 5th. And finally, IC Clear Credit LLC, which operates a major central clearinghouse for credit default swaps, CDS, has filed a proposed rule change. This one amends its rules to accommodate new index series for clearing.
Meaning?
CDS indices are periodically updated or rolled to reflect changes in the underlying basket of credits. This rule change ensures that IC Clear Credit systems and rules are ready to smoothly handle the clearing and settlement of trades involving these newly issued index series right from their official index roll date. It's an important plumbing update to ensure the safe and efficient functioning of these complex derivatives markets, reflecting the dynamic nature of financial products.
Okay, moving towards the end of the register today, a notice from the Department of Transportation, the Maritime Administration, or MARAD.
Yes, MARAD is seeking OMB review and approval for an information collection related to applications for participation in the Maritime Security Program, MSP.
What is the Maritime Security Program?
The MSP, authorized by federal statute 46 U.S.C. 5310111, is really crucial for national security and defense readiness. It allows MARAD to enter into operating agreements with operators of qualified U.S. flag, privately owned commercial vessels. In exchange for an annual stipend, these operators agree to make their ships and commercial transportation resources available to the Department of Defense during times of war or national emergency. It ensures the U.S. maintains a fleet of commercially viable yet militarily useful vessels ready to support defense sealift needs and maintain essential commerce during crises. This data collection covers the initial applications and any subsequent amendments from vessel operators wanting to enroll ships in the maritime security fleet. Marad estimates about 15 respondents with around 212 responses annually, taking between 1 and 6 hours per response. The impact. This collection is vital for Marad to administer the MSP effectively, ensuring the readiness and capacity of the U.S. Merchant Marine Fleet, which is a critical strategic asset for the nation.
Now, for a notice from the Department of the Treasury, specifically the Office of Foreign Assets Control, or OFAC, this is the office that deals with U.S. economic and trade sanctions. This notice is about sanctions action, individuals. What's the direct implication of being named on OFAC's main sanctions list?
Right. OFAC is publishing the names of persons, and persons can mean individuals or entities like companies or organizations that have been added to its main blacklist, the Specially Designated Nationals and Blocked Persons List, SDN list. When a person or entity is added to the SDN list, the implications are immediate and severe. All of their property and interests in property that are subject to U.S. jurisdiction, meaning within the U.S. or held by U.S. persons, are immediately blocked or frozen. And, maybe even more importantly, U.S. persons, which includes U.S. citizens, residents, companies, and financial institutions, are generally prohibited from engaging in any transactions or dealings whatsoever with those listed SDMs. This action was formally issued on August 13, 2025.
Does this notice give any examples?
Yes. A notable example included in this specific notice is an entity called Cooperative des Artisanaux Miniers du Congo, CDMC. This entity was designated under the sanctions program related to the Democratic Republic of Congo, DRC. Why? For activities threatening the peace, security, or stability of the DRC. Specifically, OFAC determined it was involved in the illicit trade in natural resources, like conflict minerals, and had provided support to armed groups operating in the region.
So OFAC sanctions are a major foreign policy tool.
Absolutely. They are a powerful instrument of U.S. foreign policy and national security. They're designed to counter threats like terrorism, narcotics trafficking, weapons proliferation, human rights abuses, and actions undermining democratic processes or regional stability, like in the DRC case. They do this by isolating targeted individuals and entities from the U.S. financial system and discouraging others from dealing with them. The full SDN list and details on all OFAC sanctions programs are publicly available on the Treasury Department's website for compliance purposes.
Okay, another one from Treasury, this time the Internal Revenue Service, the IRS. A notice regarding the Superfund tax on chemical substances. They're requesting comments on a petition to modify the list of taxable substances, specifically looking at ethylene, propylene, dicyclopentadiene, rubber. First, what is the Superfund tax and what is this chemical?
Okay, the Superfund tax, technically known as the Hazardous Substance Superfund Financing Rate, is an excise tax imposed on the sale or use of certain taxable chemicals and, separately, on certain imported substances derived from those chemicals. Historically, the revenue from this tax helped fund the EPA's Superfund program, which cleans up abandoned or uncontrolled hazardous waste sites across the country. The tax expired for many years, but was reinstated and expanded recently. This notice announces that the IRS has received a petition asking to add a specific substance, ethylene, propylene, dicyclopentadiene, rubber, to the list of imported substances subject to the tax.
That's quite a name. What is it used for?
It is. It's often abbreviated as EPDM rubber. It's a type of synthetic rubber known for its durability, good resistance to heat, cold, weather, chemicals. It's used in a lot of applications, like automotive hoses and seals, roofing membranes, electrical insulation, belts, and other industrial rubber goods. The notice even includes its complex chemical formula, C2H4-C3H6-C10H12O.
So is it now taxable?
Not yet. And this is a really important caveat the IRS makes clear in the notice. This is not a final determination that EPDM rubber will be added to the taxable list. It is explicitly just a notice of filing and request for comments on the petition itself. The IRS is asking for public input from manufacturers, importers, trade associations, anyone with relevant information on whether EPDM rubber meets the statutory requirements to be listed as a taxable substance. Comments are requested on or before October 14, 2025.
What's the potential impact if it is eventually added?
If the petition is ultimately approved after review and consideration of comments, then manufacturers who use taxable chemicals to produce EPDM rubber or importers who bring EPDM rubber into the U.S. would become subject to the Superfund excise tax on it. This would potentially increase the cost of this rubber and products made from it, and the revenue would contribute to the Superfund Trust Fund for environmental remediation efforts. It directly impacts the chemical and rubber industries.
All right, last agency for today. The Department of Veterans Affairs, the VA, they have several notices, mostly related to their systems of records under the Privacy Act. First, a modification to their National Patient Database's VA System of Records, SOR. What's being updated here concerning veteran health information?
Right. The VA is publishing a notice detailing comprehensive revisions to this major system of records, which covers veteran health information held in national databases. The modifications include updates to things like the categories of individuals covered by the system, the types of records maintained, the sources of the information, and, critically, updates to the routine uses.
Routine uses. That's how the information can be shared, right?
Exactly. Routine uses define the circumstances under which the VA can disclose information from the system without the individual veteran's explicit written consent, but only for purposes compatible with why the information was collected in the first place. A really crucial point the VA emphasizes in this notice is the strict adherence to privacy laws. Information protected by IPAA, the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, and by the VA's own specific privacy statute, 38 U.S.C. 7332, which covers records related to substance abuse, HIV, sickle cell anemia, cannot be disclosed under a routine use unless there is explicit disclosure authority in both provisions. That provides a strong dual layer of protection for particularly sensitive veteran medical data.
What are some examples of these routine uses?
They allow disclosure, under specific conditions, to federal, state, local, tribal, or foreign law enforcement agencies for investigations, to VA contractors for program reviews or accreditation purposes, to national certifying bodies for professional licensing decisions regarding healthcare providers, to the CDC and other public health authorities for disease tracking or biosurveillance, and to other federal agencies for things like data breach response. The notice also details the security measures used to protect the data restricting access to VA employees with a need to know, using unique, periodically changed passwords, physical security for storage locations, etc. The system has a long history, dating back to 1975, with its last full update published in June 2021. The impact of these modifications is to ensure the VA's management of highly sensitive veteran patient data remains compliant with current laws, secure, and supports efficient healthcare delivery, research, quality improvement, and oversight, all while rigorously protecting veteran privacy.
Okay. The VA is also introducing a brand new system of records for something called the Federal Immersive Learning Management System, FED-ILMS-VA. What is this, and why is it significant?
This is interesting. The VA is establishing this entirely new system of records, SOR, to manage user information for this FED-ILMS platform. Its purpose is to provide access to immersive learning and training think virtual reality or augmented reality-based training for both VA employees and potentially non-VA users, like community partners or trainees. The system will track things like training completion, assist with troubleshooting user access issues, and solicit feedback on the effectiveness of the immersive training provided. The system manager is listed as the Associate Director for Training within the VA's Office of Healthcare Innovation and Learning.
What's the significance of this?
It really reflects the VA's ongoing investment in leveraging modern technology for training and professional development, particularly in the complex field of healthcare. Using immersive learning could potentially enhance skills, improve patient safety, and provide realistic training scenarios in a safe environment. Establishing the system allows them to manage user access and track the effectiveness of these new training modalities for both their own workforce and potentially external partners, ultimately aiming to contribute to higher quality care for veterans. Comments on this new system are due within 30 days of publication.
And finally, the VA is modifying another existing system of records, non-VA care, FEE, Records VA. What's the focus here, and how does it relate to veteran services?
This modification updates the system of records that manages information related to veterans receiving healthcare services outside the VA's own direct facilities, but for which the VA is responsible for payment. This is often called community care or fee basis care. This is increasingly important as the VA relies more on networks of community providers to ensure veterans have timely access to care, especially if they live far from a VA facility or need specialized services not available at the VA.
So what do these records track?
The records are used primarily to determine a veteran's or beneficiary's eligibility for this non-VA care, and then to authorize and pay for the services provided by those community doctors, hospitals, or clinics. A key change highlighted in this notice is an update to the policies and practices for retention and disposal of records. They're aligning the retention schedule with a specific item, Records Control Schedule 10-1, Item 6000.9, to ensure consistent and proper record keeping for both financial auditing and clinical accountability purposes. Similar to the other patient data systems, the notice details robust safeguards: access restricted to authorized VA employees using unique passwords, physical security at storage locations, and disclosures must follow strict privacy guidelines, including IPALA and 38 USC 7332, with routine uses allowing necessary sharing with law enforcement, other providers involved in care, etc., only for specific authorized purposes related to managing and paying for that care. The impact here is about streamlining the administrative processes behind veterans receiving community care, making it more efficient to determine eligibility, authorize services, and process payments accurately. It's part of the VA's ongoing effort to adapt and improve healthcare access for veterans, ensuring the systems supporting community care are robust and compliant.
Wow. Taylor, what an incredible journey, really, through just a single day's worth of the Federal Register. It's quite overwhelming when you see it all laid out. The incredibly granular details of shared oxygen systems on private jets, all the way to the broad sweep of national housing grants supporting thousands, and from, you know, temporary emergency scheduling of dangerous drugs to the really intricate rules governing financial markets and international trade. It is just crystal clear the federal government is constantly at work, often in ways most of us never see.
It really is. And what's fascinating, I think, when you look at it like this, is how these seemingly disparate actions, pensions, seals, drugs, airplanes, trade duties, are all somehow interconnected threads in this huge, complex fabric of governance. We saw the government responding to immediate emerging threats like those synthetic opioids. We saw it adapting regulations to keep pace with new technologies in aviation and finance. We saw it trying to balance environmental protection, like for harbor seals, with necessary infrastructure projects, even beneficial restoration projects, and constantly working to ensure the smooth and hopefully fair operation of our economy through trade enforcement and financial market regulation.
It really does drive home that idea you mentioned at the start, the Federal Register, as a kind of shortcut to being genuinely well-informed. It's not just reading the headlines. It's seeing the underlying directives, the proposed changes, the rationale, the sheer mechanics behind government action.
Exactly. And it really makes you wonder, doesn't it? This raises that important question. How many of these seemingly small or maybe overly technical rules, notices, and proposed changes that we discussed today will quietly, perhaps invisibly, shape our daily lives, our economy, our environment in the coming months and years? What is the hidden ripple effect of just a single one of these entries in the Federal Register? And maybe more provocatively, what will tomorrow's edition reveal about the next layer, the next set of challenges and responses in the ongoing work of government?
That is a powerful thought to leave everyone with. Thank you so much for guiding us through that today. And thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the Federal Register. We really hope you found these insights valuable, maybe a little eye-opening, and certainly thought-provoking. Until next time, keep digging into the details.
Absolutely. There's always more to learn, always more to uncover, and we look forward to exploring it with you again soon.